Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The economic word of the day today is minutes, as in 1/60th of an hour, or notes or summary of a meeting. We'll use it both ways. And you know what this economy needs, ladies and gentlemen? It needs a good poem. That's what it needs. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Wake up to the day's top business headlines. Subscribe to the Marketplace Morning Report podcast. It's on iTunes and marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Great to have you with us on this Wednesday, the 21st of August. This is the Marketplace podcast for today. There are times in this economy when the slightest twitch, the merest hint of something unexpected or outside the norm, takes on added significance. Exhibit A was provided to us this afternoon by the Federal Reserve Bank of the United States, specifically the minutes of its most recent meeting in July. Seems the Fed can't really decide what it thinks about the economy and when exactly it ought to stop its big bond buying program. That kind of thing, as you know, makes Wall Street crazy. Traders drove all three major indices down and then brought them right back up again once they decided the end of the world was not apparently nigh. All right, hey, here's another item in the small glitches that loom large category. Also, as it happens, revolving around the word minutes. A computerized system at Goldman Sachs made a series of mistakes yesterday over a period of about 17 minutes or so that did a number on options trading, and not in a good way either. Regulators trying to clean things up today, as Marketplace's Jeff Tyler tells us.
Call it computer error. Data meant only for internal consumption at Goldman Sachs was sent to a different computer system that executes trades on the options market.
What happened was the computer program mistakenly started to sell options at like $1 an option, when in fact the market price was higher than that.
That's New York University professor Richard Silla.
Basically, Goldman sold a lot of options cheaply, and if they have to buy them back, they will lose money because they'll have to pay the market price for them.
Goldman Sachs is working with the exchanges to try to cancel some of the erroneous trades, but the firm could still be on the hook for losses in the millions. And it isn't an isolated incident. Adam Sussman is with the TAB Group.
We've seen a number of trading errors both here in the U.S. as well as in other markets over the course of the last, you know, 2 or 3 years.
Computer malfunction in China last week sent stocks gyrating. And all these technical kinks make Silla long for the old way of trading.
There have been not a lot, but still too many technical, electronic problems in these markets. And they suggest to me that the old system where people traded face-to-face, it wasn't quite so bad.
But there's no turning back from computer trading. Kevin Nichols is with LiveVol, a company that analyzes the options market.
We care about being able to go faster and hit the market faster and respond to news events faster. We definitely just have to respond when things go wrong faster as well.
Responding to yesterday's breakdown, Goldman Sachs said it's working with the exchanges to resolve the issue, and any potential losses won't hurt the firm's finances. I'm Jeff Tyler for Marketplace.
You know what the problem is with making money on the internet? There just aren't enough people on the internet is the problem. So today we had Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg making a big announcement, something called Internet.org, which is going to try to lower the cost of internet connectivity, most specifically in the developing world. Facebook is partnering with companies like Samsung and Ericsson, to name just a couple, to make mobile apps run more efficiently, helping to develop the developing world, if you will. And yes, it sounds like philanthropy, but it's not. Here's Marketplace's Noel King.
Internet.org's website looks like the website of a traditional nonprofit. On the homepage, there's a video of African children playing and women working in the fields, and a voiceover with that famous JFK speech about how we all inhabit this small planet.
We all breathe the same air. We all cherish our children's futures, and we are all mortal.
It's inspiring, yes. It's also good for the companies behind Internet.org, because people in developing countries can't join, say, Facebook, unless they're on the internet.
This new generation of people like Mark Zuckerberg understand that to develop those markets in the developing world, you've got to build up the infrastructure and invest up front.
The economist Matthew Bishop coined the term for this phenomenon, philanthrocapitalism, and co-authored a book about it. He says it's a growing trend. And tech giants aren't the only ones moving in this direction. Unilever is working to improve sanitation in poor countries and at the same time promoting their toilet cleaner, Domestos. But the initiative strikes some as even more ambitious than philanthrocapitalism. Rob Riesch of Stanford University's Center on Philanthropy and Civil Society points to language in Zuckerberg's mission statement.
Because they have announced it as a political aspiration, connectivity as a basic human right, that is going to require political coordination in addition to business coordination.
As long as Facebook isn't trying, for example, to be the sole provider of the internet in the developing world, Riesch says the link between their bottom line and the promotion of a public good strikes him as a happy coincidence. I'm Noel King for Marketplace.
Funnily enough, once Wall Street fully digested the Fed minutes, traders decided they actually didn't like what they said. Go figure. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. We've all gotten used to fees when we travel. Airlines mostly, of course. You pay to check your bags, you pay to get some extra legroom, you pay to eat. That's just the way it is when you fly. But now, just like the airlines, hotels are charging extra for things that once upon a time cost nothing at all. Peter O'Dowd reports now from KJZZ in Phoenix, Arizona.
The Clarendon Hotel is a hip landmark in central Phoenix. If you stay here tonight, you'll pay about $90 for the room. But wait, there's more.
Our fee is $20 per night.
Owner Ben Bethel started charging a hotel service fee in 2008.
And that fee does include internet, parking, international calls, unlimited minibar food and soft drinks.
And a welcoming foot massage. 5 years ago, the recession was raging, and Bethel says he needed the cash. Other hotels were slashing nightly room rates. The service fee allowed the Clarendon to stay competitive.
We saw revenue come in the neighborhood of about $400,000 per year, which really did help us to keep the doors open and keep a lot of people employed.
All across sunshiny Phoenix, resorts and hotels have used fees to boost revenue. Bethel says the key is giving guests value for their extra money. But some resort fees go toward a yoga class that you may never take. Others include the tip for the maid.
It's becoming a near universal practice.
New York University's Bjorn Hansen has been tracking resort fees and hotel surcharges nationally for more than a decade. He says 2013 will be another record, $2.1 billion. Here's a big reason why.
Travelers are so sensitive to room rates, a $2 change will have a dramatic shift in market share.
So hotels leave the room rate alone and charge a fee instead.
It just is the reality. More and more guests are understanding and accept these charges. And frankly, the airline industry has provided cover for the lodging industry.
Hansen says hotels started charging fees before the airlines ever did. It's just that airlines have gotten a lot more flack from passengers repulsed by the thought of paying for every bag of peanuts. Plus, Hansen says airline fees still far outpace the lodging industry.
Come on, swim. You want to swim?
Yeah.
Okay, let's go.
Meanwhile, hotels are grappling with ways to charge extra and keep their customers happy. On a scorching hot day at the Hotel Valley Ho in the Phoenix suburb of Scottsdale, a handful of guests splash around the pool, free of charge. Spokeswoman Kristen Hegley says there is no hotel service fee here.
We really believe in charging guests for what they use, not what they might use.
And the hotel makes a point of telling customers what it doesn't charge for, like newspapers.
Free.
Shine my shoes?
Free.
Parking is free, too, unless you want a valet to park your car in the shaded garage. No charge for internet unless you want an upgrade.
When we can offer something complimentary and it works, we definitely do it.
This matters to guest Sue McMeekin, who lives in San Francisco and travels once a month. She's just fed up with airports and hotels.
And it's kind of deceiving. You get a price for your hotel room, and by the time you check out, it's like a sticker shock. You know, that's just it. It's just the hidden stuff you don't expect.
But at the Valley Ho, she knows exactly what to expect. And that's a big reason she comes back. In Phoenix, I'm Peter O'Dowd for Marketplace.
been a tough, tough summer for organizations that rely on unpaid interns. Those interns have sued and won and gotten a whole lot of press. Press, it seems, that the White House somehow hasn't been reading. Interns there, it turns out, don't get paid either. Kate Davidson has more now on who gets those coveted White House spots and at what cost.
The Fair Pay Campaign is a brand new advocacy group pushing the White House to pay its interns. Mikey Franklin is the man behind it.
The only people that can afford to do unpaid internships are people that can afford to work for free. And that's a very narrow subset of people that might want to do a White House internship.
This summer's crop of 150 interns includes 40 Ivy League students or recent graduates. We know because we made our intern count them. And it's reported to include the children of political insiders Larry Summers, Ron Klain, and Steve Rattner. Jeff Kavanaugh became a White House intern in the spring of 2004 precisely because he thought the experience would boost his resume.
And as a matter of fact, it did do that. I actually went back after I graduated from college and was on staff in the same department at the White House.
Kavanaugh, who got college credit for his internship, worked his way through school and took out loans. Barry Bluestone of Northeastern University worries that these days so many students are being forced into debt that it limits their internship options.
If those internships don't pay, it becomes more and more difficult for students to pay for their tuition.
President Obama is embarking on a bus tour tomorrow to talk about college affordability. It doesn't appear as though internships are on the agenda. I'm Kate Davidson for Marketplace.
Coming up.
So I turned around after a couple of hours of doing this and I said, sir, is this legal to do this? And he said, you are fired.
Another story of first jobs. It was a short one, let me tell you that. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials tacked down 105 points by the time everything was done today. That's 2/3 of 1%. 14,897 is the number you're looking for. The NASDAQ threw off 13 points, about 1/3 of 1%, finished at 35.99. The S&P 500 ticked down 9 points, 0.6%, ended things at 16.42. The unhappy reaction to July's Federal Reserve minutes led us to the sixth straight day in the red for the Dow, longest losing streak since July 2012, should you be one of those who keeps track of those sorts of things. Goldman Sachs down 1.5% today amid reports of the trading errors we reported on earlier. J.P. Morgan Chase, Morgan Stanley, and Citigroup all slipped as well. Bank of America bucked the financials trend up 1/3 of 1%. Staples punched down 15% today after the office supply chain revealed poor sales in Europe and Australia. A good afternoon, though. At Tuesday morning, shares in the discount home goods retailer jumped 23% today. Bond prices down. The yield on the 10-year T-note up to 2.89%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Show Marketplace how much you like us. Stay connected to our hosts, reporters, and top stories on Facebook. Find us at facebook.com/APM Marketplace.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at what's coming up Thursday. The Conference Board releases its monthly index of leading economic indicators for July. It's probably a stop on your lifelong quest for the perfect pair of jeans. Gap reports quarterly earnings. And during her lifetime, she doled out some sage advice. Take care of the luxuries, and the necessities will take care of themselves. Writer Dorothy Parker was born on August 22, 1893. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdahl. I don't know if you caught it last week, but the Eurozone is officially not in a recession anymore. It's a big deal, Europe being Europe and all. France was one of the countries returning to at least a modicum of growth. But despite the faint wisp of good news, unemployment there is still rising, and the French government is hard-pressed to do something about it. Christopher Wirth has the story from Paris.
It's a summer evening in the town of Trappes, just outside central Paris. And out on the street, Kader Mohamed turns up the stereo in his car and starts to rap about life in the neighborhood.
78 ma zone, 190 terre-terre. Alors, du con, imagine ce qu'on fait comme mer.
Unemployment in France is at roughly 11%, but it's even higher here in the poorer banlieues or suburbs that surround Paris. And if you're in your 20s, like Mohamed, your chances of finding a job are even worse. Youth unemployment is at a daunting 26%.
Chile, te attrape et pas à Paname.
Mohamed says he lost his job on a Peugeot assembly line 6 months ago, and he's angry French President François Hollande hasn't done enough to solve the problem.
It's very difficult to find work in France because of the crisis. We hear President Hollande talk about jobs, but we see nothing. There's no work.
The lack of jobs has helped make Hollande one of the most unpopular French presidents on record. And in response, he's made what may be a very difficult promise to keep.
Here's a commitment to sustainably reverse the unemployment rate by the end of the year.
Now, ask many economists about how to do that, and they'll tell you the best way to get companies to hire more workers in France is to make it easier to fire them. Dominique Barbet of the French bank BNP Paribas says French employers are too restricted from laying off workers when business is down.
Employers hesitate before hiring people because they know that reducing staff takes a long period of time and requires the compensation to employees, which could be quite significant.
France has made some changes to strict labor laws. But to meet his pledge, Hollande is now embarking on a hiring spree. The government plans to create more than 500,000 short-term contracts this year, largely in the public sector, and it'll pick up the tab for 75% of the cost of hiring them. Many are reserved for youth from low-income areas. Virginie Gosson-Tanguy of France's National Movement of the Unemployed says it's a solution that might put money in people's pockets now.
But it's not a long-term solution, because after this contract, there is no job for them.
She says the French government is merely tinkering with the unemployment figures. Instead, advocates like her want to reduce France's already low 35-hour work week to 32 hours, which she says would ideally force businesses to hire more workers.
It might seem very strange for an American to hear that, but there is no jobs for everybody, so we need to share work.
And it's not just young workers that feel hopeless in France.
After 50 years old, if you lost your job, you never find another one.
59-year-old Catherine Barocco has spent decades in the corporate tourism industry, but she says she's gone 7 months without work.
I'm so disappointed because France is a very, very rich country, and I think the economy was really good years ago, and we just waste everything.
She has no hope Hollande can keep his promise. In fact, the International Monetary Fund expects the country's jobless rate to rise to 11.6% by next year. In Paris, I'm Christopher Wirth for Marketplace.
The business world is often perceived as cold, all about the numbers and the data and the bottom line. About as far from poetry as one might get, but some good descriptive imagery has its advantages, you know, in dealing with the frustrations of the workplace and everything else the economy can bring. Victoria Chang has a new book of poems out. It's called The Boss. And here's a hint. It ain't about Springsteen. Victoria, thanks a lot for being with us.
You're welcome.
Why poetry? What is it about this medium that's attractive to you?
You know, I think that there's something appealing to me about being able to express something that's really deep within you in the most precise manner possible with the least number of words. There's something elegant and streamlined about that. In this day and age, you just hear a lot of talk and chatter, and I think there's a quietness to poetry, and that's kind of what I enjoy about it.
How did it come to pass that you turned to poetry? I mean, you had your basic liberal arts background, and then you
right.
went to business school.
Right.
And, you know.
Yeah, no, I have an MBA from Stanford. I worked in management consulting, worked in investment banking. But, you know, the poetry was I've always had. You know, I've always written poetry, and even as a kid, I've always just loved the idea of looking so deep inside your own well. If I didn't write poetry, I don't think I would ever look in that well. And so I really think that it's always been in me ever since I was a kid, even if I was around and am around people who, you know, talk about their millions and their business strategies. And it's always just a part of me, and it's always been a part of me.
Yeah, you are in the business world now, right? I mean,
yeah.
You're a consultant, do all kinds of things.
Right,
yeah.
right. Yeah. Marketing, communications,
right.
yeah.
About this volume, it is slim, it's 45 pages, and the reason you're on this program talking about it is because the title is The Boss.
That's
These
right.
are all musings, I suppose, on the boss and employment
right.
and all that stuff.
Right. I think you know, it's just everything during that time when I wrote this book, everything I felt like was losing control. You know, my dad had this terrible stroke. I had this really challenging boss who wasn't that kind of scream-in-your-face boss, but that kind of passive-aggressive boss. That was psychologically damaging. And then I had these little kids that were under the age of 5, and everything just felt like I was losing control. And so the book became an exploration of kind of that losing control and hierarchy and how we all, to some extent, during all aspects of our lives, are always losing control.
It's not a bad metaphor. And it's funny to hear these words coming out of my mouth, since I'm a very straight ahead kind of guy. But it's not a bad metaphor for the past 5 or 6 years in this economy.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where people don't know which way is up, and
right.
and there's great uncertainty, and you
and
don't know how it's
going. And we
still
don't know, right? Yeah. And political, and not even just economically. I mean, look at what's going on. Every day it's something in Egypt, and you know, every day there's something that I think makes people feel like they're out of control. You know,
yeah.
I think it's just a different time than I remember before, like maybe pre 10 years ago.
Yeah. There are some poems in this book where you are sympathetic to the boss,
mm-hmm.
where you are understanding and
right.
and accepting. And
sure.
then there are some where you are just brutal.
Right.
Make up your mind.
Well, I think that's the complexity of human beings. I mean,
yeah.
I think you know, if you were to describe yourself, there's many multi-dimensional aspects of you. And in one day, I think you can change. And I feel like that's part of the job of a writer, is to understand all aspects of human nature. Even there's no such thing to me as pure evil necessarily. I think even the purest evil sort of people, they have multiple dimensions. And I think that's what I love to explore as a writer.
Have you ever been a boss?
Yeah. A good one. Of course.
Perhaps not the kind anybody writes books about. Very cool.
Yeah.
Very cool. As is the book, Victoria Chang. It's called The Boss. Thanks a lot for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
You can hear Victoria read one of her poems and shoot us your own work-related haikus. Let's keep them short, people. It's marketplace.org. The theme around here this week has been first jobs, that awesome new feeling of getting paid for your time. Today's first job didn't last all that long.
My name is Deborah Morse, and I am a closet designer and organizer. My first paid job was in a mall in Okemos, Michigan, where I was working in a very tiny little trinket shop for $1.65 an hour. I was supposed to have the job working 6 hours a day, 5 days a week, for a period of 3 months, but instead I only worked for 4 hours. I remember that first day vividly because the weather in Michigan was 50 below zero, and I had to walk, I know I sound like I'm 110 years old, about a mile and a half to get to this mall to try to secure this job. So when I walked in, this gentleman said, we do need somebody, and that's fine. We know the weather's bad, and you can go ahead and start. I noticed the store was messy, which really bothered me. But I finally said, what could I do? Would you let me organize this jewelry? The store was full of jewelry and cotton clothes from India. And he said, yeah, you can go ahead and tag that jewelry over there. And I said, great. And he showed me a formula how to price the jewelry. And as I was pricing it, I was noticing the jewelry was marked up 250%. I'm thinking, wow, that's a lot. So I turned around after a couple of hours of doing this, and I said, sir, is this legal to do this? And he said, you are fired. And that was my 4 hours of work in the store. When I was fired, I felt devastated. I was this shy farm girl who was trying so hard to be honest, and I just felt leveled like I was a failure. I went next door to a fabric shop, and I told them that I knew how to sew and I'd like a job. So they hired me on the spot, like the other store did, for $1.85 an hour. My honesty paid off. It really felt like it paid off. So although I received a paycheck smaller than $6,
smallest paycheck I ever received was probably one of the biggest lessons I ever had in life.
Deborah Morse is a listener to this radio program. Tell us more of your stories of first jobs or anything else you like. Letters@marketplace.org, or you can tweet us at MarketplaceAPM.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note on the way out today, I saw this yesterday, but actually forgot to tell you about it. Every year since 1998, Beloit College in Beloit, Wisconsin, has put out what it calls its mindset list, vaguely relevant pop culture references that apply to the incoming class of college freshmen. That is, this year, kids born in 1995 or so. Here's just a couple guaranteed to make you feel, well, dated. Anyway, threatening to shut down the government during federal budget negotiations has always been anticipated tactics for them. Their TV screens keep getting smaller as their parents' screens grow ever larger. While they've grown up with a World Trade Organization, they have never known an Interstate Commerce Commission. One more, and then I'm done. College kids entering college this year, for them, the U.S. has always imposed economic sanctions against Iran. The whole list is at our website. It is marketplace.org. And that is Marketplace Radio Program from American Public Media on this Wednesday. Dow Industrial's off 105 points today, 2/3%, 14,897. Blame the Fed if you want to blame somebody. The NASDAQ threw off 13 points, about 1/3 of 1%, 35.99. At the bell, the S&P 500 might have lost 9 points, 0.6% on that index, ended things at 1642. Carlos Asensio, Ravi Carman, Chris Clark, Stephen Colon, Bill Lance, Jeff Peters, Charlton Thorpe, Brendan Willard, and Randy Wine engineered the broadcast for us. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.